This edition of Midori House was first broadcast on the 16th of April 2015 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Steve Bloomfield. On today's programme, Russian President Vladimir Putin has just finished his annual marathon televised phone-in. We tuned in to Ask Vlad, so you didn't have to. We'll discuss the highlights. Also ahead, Marco Rubio thinks he'd make a good Republican nominee as the race to the White House continues to simmer. But his approach to climate change might come back to haunt him, especially in his home state of Florida.
The climate's always changing. That's not the fundamental question. The fundamental question is whether man-made activity is what's contributing most to it. I understand that people say there's a significant scientific consensus on that issue, but I've actually seen reasonable debate on that principle.
Has he? Greece's credit rating has been downgraded again. Bookmakers have stopped taking bets on the country leaving the euro. Has the nation's economy reached a new low? All that plus we'll also look ahead to Monocle's Quality of Life conference this weekend in Lisbon. That's all to come in the next 30 minutes here on Midori House with me, Steve Bloomfield. My guests today are Nina Schick, Director of Communications at the EU policy think tank Open Europe, and the political historian and author James Boyes. James and Nina, welcome both to the programme. We're going to begin with Russia. And Vladimir Putin is probably tucked away in bed right now after his annual marathon TV phone-in discussion with the nation today. 3 million questions flooded in for the Russian president, with topics varying from the sale of milk to primary schools to, of course, the killing of Russian opposition leader Boris Nemtsov, with Putin obviously very well known for keeping Russian media tightly bound to his strings. How likely is it that any of these questions came as a surprise? Nina Schick, this is a, on the whole, incredibly stage managed process, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. I was just surprised to see that there wasn't a surprise guest speaker last year. Of course, they had a whistleblower there. But the interesting thing about what he said today is primarily 3 points. So he spoke about the Russian economy and how it's doing better. And it is actually doing better, much to the surprise of many economic forecasts, which thought that by now the ruble would have completely crashed. But it seems to be doing better, partly because the oil price seems to have stabilized and hit the lowest it can go. And of course, they also, Putin also said that they'll be selling, revamping a sale of missiles to Iran, which has ruffled a lot of feathers in Washington and, of course, in Israel. And perhaps the most ridiculous thing was that Putin also said regarding Ukraine that there were no Russian soldiers there. And there was all the propaganda one can imagine that goes about, you know, Russia's stance on Ukraine, including children brought out onto stage doing Q&A.
Yes, there was a four-year-old child from
refugees.
from Eastern Ukraine, sort of giving their views on the situation. There was also he got involved in a family dispute about a pet dog at one stage, and proper sort of leadership stuff. James Boyes, I mean, you know, in a sense, there are, you know, this is his opportunity to reach a large audience, mm-hmm. Not just in Russia, sure. But the rest of the world as well. And as Nina said, you know, he had some points he really wanted to make.
Yeah, absolutely. We can mock it, and that's certainly appropriate. But ultimately, you know, we're talking about it, you know, so mission accomplished to a certain extent. When we think about this, there's no doubt about it that it is stage managed. There is clearly a lot of planted questions, if not all of them. I mean, what would you expect from this guy's background with the KGB? But he's doing something that the rest of the world leaders don't. I mean, we don't have an opportunity to phone in and speak with David Cameron like this, or with Barack Obama, for example. And you've got to wonder why they don't follow this lead. It seems to be an obvious way of trying to get involved in direct democracy. I mean, take the stage management element out of it, but you get that anywhere. I mean, if you look at Obama, for example, one of the things that he has done is, as president, he's moved away from the idea of speaking from behind the Resolute desk in the Oval Office to having, you know, a stage managed situation with normal citizens behind him, the idea that he's representing all Americans, black, white, Hispanic, men, women, etc., etc. So that's a staged managed event, as Putin's talking about here. So, you know, when we talk about politics, it's easy to recognize it in the opposition when we talk about propaganda, but our own leaders obviously engage in it on a regular basis themselves.
And when we talk about stage managed photo ops and discussions with ordinary people, certainly in this country, Nina, over the last two or three weeks, we've seen an awful lot of it. And we're going to see a lot up to May the 7th. I mean, this is just what politics is now, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. And I think there's an interesting point that James raised about how politicians are trying to, you know, be more accessible to the people, etc., by doing things such as Twitter and so on. But because in this context, in the Western kind of democratic context, it isn't stage managed and, you know, the questions aren't always pre-prepped, that always leads to fantastic, horrible situations. For example, you know, certain politicians tweeting something highly inappropriate and so on. But yeah, we've been seeing a lot of that in the UK leading up to the election, and I'm sure we'll see more. I don't know if it's very glamorous, but...
It's interesting to think about this. I was just looking at this point, that Nina mentioned, this idea that Putin here has denied Russian involvement in the Ukraine. I mean, it rings bells to me of when, you know, we look at that and think it was a barefaced lie. When Gerry Ford was president in his debates and he denied in 1976 there was any Soviet invasion or domination of Eastern Europe.
That was different. That was a howler. But that was because he didn't know what he was talking about. This here with Putin isn't that he doesn't know what he's talking about. It's that this is the line he's chosen to take and he's sticking with it.
I think the situation with Ford wasn't that he didn't know what he was on about. I think he made a massive howling mistake and didn't have the common sense to walk it back on the night, which arguably cost him the election in 76. Here it's a barefaced lie, and it's just remarkable that he's got the temerity to get away with it.
But Nina, he doesn't just have the temerity to get away with it, he can get away with it mm-hmm. inside Russia, can't he?
Absolutely, and his popularity rating has rocketed ever since, you know, the crisis in Ukraine began. One of the interesting things I think about today was, again, as he has been doing, you know, very strong rhetoric against America. And he's been playing this whole, because the 70th anniversary of, you know, the defeat against the Nazis mm-hmm. is coming up and there are Victory Day celebrations. And a lot of European leaders aren't going to be going for obvious reasons. And he said, you know, that was because of American tyranny and so on. So, and there's another interesting story attached to that, actually. There's this kind of vigilante gang of motorcyclists called the Night Wolves, who seem to be Putin's kind of backup crew. And they're apparently going to do a victory drive across Europe to celebrate the 70th anniversary defeat of fascism. So that is certainly...
Are they going to get visas? Well, I'm not entirely sure how that's going to work.
I don't think some of the Baltic countries are, in Eastern, Central and Eastern European countries are too happy about that.
No,
so we'll see. We'll watch that one.
They're not going to be that happy about any Russians sort of crossing the border doing any sort of victory celebrations. James Boyes, on that on that point of the victory in Europe celebrations or commemorations, whatever you want to call them, coming up in May. I mean, when we've been looking at what might happen with, in Japan, with, is Shinzo Abe going to use the events there to make a sort of a proper apology to China or to try and build fences with Korea? It's a shame, isn't it, that here in Europe, that political leaders aren't able to, think, okay, well, look, this is an opportunity where we're all going to come together mm-hmm. and commemorate what happened 70 years ago, and hopefully that can, lead to some sort of rapprochement now.
I think we need to be a little bit careful here because, if you go, okay, it's a 70th anniversary. 70 isn't necessarily an anniversary. One always springs to mind. You think, we must mark the 70th anniversary of something. You go back 20 years to the 50th anniversary. There were celebrations and there was a coming together and the world was a little bit more optimistic at that point, don't forget. Going back to the, what that'd be like, the mid-90s, I guess, when you had Clinton and Yeltsin, and there was a sense of that rapprochement there. The Cold War was ending, the EU come together, and there was a greater sense of unity. It's a sense that we've moved backwards, I think, which is most disappointing. But I think we need to hold out and say, okay, fair enough. What's going to happen in 5 years when we get to 75, for example? That's a more recognised, I think, anniversary. At 70, I think some people could be mistaken for thinking, I can miss this one. It's not a big one. And obviously, with the difficulties that the West is having now with Putin, I think we need to recognise this hopefully is a lull in the storm and that things will can only get better. Let's throw that little one into the mix.
I think that the reason why they're focusing on 70 is perhaps not for the reasons that it's a big anniversary, but it's probably the last major anniversary mm-hmm. where lots of people involved might still be alive. Nina, but the thing with diplomacy is that lots of people tend to sort of ignore a lot of the time, is that it involves talking to people that you don't like. Yeah. It involves talking to your enemies. And surely this was, you know, this would have been an opportunity for people to come together and have a little chat on the sidelines. Yeah, maybe people like Angela Merkel will say, look, I've spoken with Vladimir Putin on the sidelines of many, many things, and it's got us nowhere. But it seems a little disappointing that they're not even attempting something.
Well, I think it's all about juggling the various forces at play. So Merkel, as you mentioned, I mean, she's the ultimate diplomat and the ultimate pragmatist. And she's the only kind of European and Western leader who, you know, does talk a lot to Putin. And that only kind of changed at the end of last year when she was so disappointed by Russia's actions in Ukraine that she made quite a harsh speech at the G20 summit. But until that point, you know, she was very, even though she personally doesn't like Putin very much, you know, was very much trying to do the rapprochement, and still is. Germany still is. The foreign ministers of Germany, France, Ukraine and Russia were just in Berlin the other day trying to still hammer out the details for, you know, to agree the Minsk agreement. But one has to remember that players like Merkel, she also has to think about the Central and Eastern European countries who have been very, very vocal about, you know, what's going on in Ukraine for obvious historical reasons. They're very afraid of this boisterous brand of Russian nationalism, shall we call it. And relations between Berlin and Warsaw have actually cooled down a lot, even though they're very, very important allies, because they think Berlin hasn't been tough enough on Putin and Russia.
Let's move on now. For most normal people, climate change is fact, not a theory that deserves to be tested. For White House hopeful Marco Rubio, however, things are apparently still up in the air. The Republican presidential candidate has in the past steered clear of referring to global warming as a man-made issue. But it's a stance that may come back to haunt him, with an analysis by the Yale Project on Climate Change Communication finding that over half of those from Rubio's home state of Florida disagree with his position. James Boyes, it may well be that most people believe what most people in the world believe, that climate change is real and it's man-made. But Marco Rubio has to get the votes of Republican primary voters, doesn't he? And they tend to think slightly differently.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's fair to say that we're going to have a lot of fun over the next 18 months when we think about some of the things which are going to be coming out of the campaign trail from both the Democrats and the Republicans. At the moment, there are more Republicans in the race, so they're providing an awful lot more ammunition. And as you rightly point out, Marco Rubio, a senator out of Florida, has come out with a statement with regard to climate change. He's someone who I think is going to be putting an awful lot of interesting positions forward. He is of Cuban heritage, so he's already now talking about opposing the idea of the Cuban deal that Obama's put on the table. Even if, quote, 99% of Americans are against it, he wants to be against it. I make the claim, then it follows into this point, that it never does to be against what 99% of voters want. And certainly with regard to this position on climate change, there clearly has been a shift over the last couple of years towards a position that, you know, whatever one believes of it, you know, there is a recognition that climate change has been happening. It has obviously impacted issues to do with Florida. If you spend much time in that part of the world, it's very much affected by the climate. He really is, I think, at this point, pandering to the right, which he needs to do, as you rightly point out, to get the nomination. And you will see, I think, all the Republicans doing this. They'll move to the right to get the nomination and then try and race to the center ground to get the general election. And it's how far they have to go to the right to get the nomination that will impact how successful they are come November 2016.
And Nina, it's not just climate change, it's things like evolution as well. We had Scott Walker, the governor of Wisconsin, was in London 2 or 3 months ago, and he was asked by a journalist at Chatham House, you know, do you believe in evolution? He was like, oh, I think I'll pass on that one. It's, you know, to those that either don't follow American politics obsessively or aren't American, it all sounds a little bit odd at times, doesn't it?
Yeah, I mean, exactly. From the kind of European perspective, you wouldn't imagine that at all. And one of the other things is religion, you know, the kind of central role that religion plays in US elections. That would be completely out of the ordinary in the European context, specifically here in the UK or in countries like Germany. So from the European kind of angle, it seems a bit odd. And, you know, Rubio's kind of rebuttal that he kind of sidestepped the climate change issue, saying, well, I'm not a scientist, so I don't know. I don't know if that really holds much weight.
James, do you think there's going to be some Republican candidates, maybe not this time around, but soon, that start to try and move away from what have become these sort of tests to see whether you really are one of us, whether that's climate change, evolution, maybe even same-sex marriage? Would you think we'll actually have a Republican candidate who says, yes, I'm all for same-sex marriage?
Well, what's fascinating about that is the gay marriage argument has been lost by the Republicans in the United States. I mean, again, you know, it's very easy to brand all Republicans as the same, and I get that from a European perspective. But the argument for gay marriage has been won effectively in the United States now at a statewide level. It's happening. It's over 30 states, so it's not a major issue at this point. I'm going to be fascinated to see what Jeb Bush does when he enters the race, because he has to try and position himself as a moderate, I think, if he's going to try and win this. Fascinatingly enough, we talk about the crazies in the Republican Party, but when you actually look at who gets the nomination, it's never the crazies. I just point this out. It's the more moderate, mainstream candidates.
It might be the people that say they're moderate, but there are also people that, you know, Mitt Romney last time talked about immigrants should self-deport. You know, I don't even understand what that means.
Well, if you thought that was daft, you should have seen some of the things that other candidates were saying. I think what's going to be fascinating, you're absolutely right, to get back in the White House, to get any credibility back with the country and internationally, the Republicans need to come in from the fringe. I was actually at the Scott Walker event at Chatham House that you were talking about, and it was fascinating to see. He refused to talk about foreign policy when he was overseas. He was speaking at Chatham House, for crying out loud. It's a think tank on foreign affairs. He's coming back to Europe now. He's going to Israel. He's still refusing to talk about foreign policy. It undermines his entire credibility.
James Boyes and Nina Schick, thank you both for now. We're back in a moment and we'll be talking about Europe. You're listening to Midori House.
On Saturday, the 18th of April, tune in to Monocle 24 to hear full live coverage of Monocle's inaugural Quality of Life Conference, which is taking place in Lisbon, Portugal.
With the help of 20 speakers, we're going to reveal the best projects, people and practices helping to create dynamic cities around the globe.
Our special guests include legendary typographer Eric Spiekerman, renowned London-based designer Ilse Crawford, and the V&A's director Martin Roth.
The day's sessions will explore how media brands make our cities.
You'll discover how to build the perfect house.
You'll hear how to reinvent the high street and explore the role of culture in our urban spaces.
All that plus music from Luisa Sobral too.
Yes, intenção que vindo ao carro até pensar.
And you can hear it all right here on Monocle 24.
Tune in for full coverage of the first Monocle Quality of Life Conference, live from Lisbon on the 18th of April. Our special coverage begins at 9 a.m. London time.
Find out more at conference.monocle.com.
For me, quality of life, I think, is probably a lot to do with the ease of doing things that you want to do. Transport, finding a good coffee, relaxing, enjoying culture. Having those things close at hand and having them, you know, easy things to do is something that definitely brings quality of life. London is kind of a tricky quality of life city. It offers, you know, a huge variety of things to do and really incredible exhibitions and people and really dynamic businesses. But, you know, they're quite spread out and often very expensive. And, you know, the weather isn't totally supportive 100% of the time. Still, it's a really hard city to beat simply for its, you know, for its internationalism and its ambition and all of the different things that it offers you. The most important feature of London's cultural institutions, I think, as they relate to quality of life, is definitely the fact that, you know, most major galleries are free. Certainly that helps make them really democratic places and helps support the idea that they're, you know, in some ways public space as well. I think probably the greatest challenge for London in terms of its quality of life is definitely the housing market, the kind of power of private developers over, you know, in some cases, the public interest. And that's definitely a major challenge for the city going forward.
Yeah.
You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Steve Bloomfield. You just heard there from Monocle's contributing editor and producer, David Michon. He was speaking about what quality of life meant to him. And we'll be talking a bit more about Monocle's Quality of Life conference, our first ever conference, which starts in Lisbon this Saturday. We'll talk about it a bit more towards the end of the programme. Still with me here in Studio One, Nina Schick and James Boyes. Let's talk about Greece now. Just as things seem to be getting back on track, the nation has copped another slap, this time from the SNP. The ratings agency has downgraded Greece's credit rating, saying that its debt and financial commitments are unsustainable and they'll likely default in May. William Hill has also stopped taking bets on Greece falling out of the euro before the end of the year. Greece is still negotiating with the International Monetary Fund, but if the country is forced to choose between paying the IMF or the wages of the country's own employees, things could get rather tense, Nina Schick, couldn't they?
Oh, yeah. I mean, the whole Greece saga has been now going on for 2 months ever since, you know, the new Syriza government was elected. And it couldn't be worse. I mean, there's been no point in the eurozone crisis where Greece has looked more likely to leave the euro than now. And there was a report that Greece actually approached the IMF today, asking whether or not they could delay the repayment of their fund, because in May they are due to pay the IMF $1 billion. Of course, Greek officials have denied that this happened. And even Christine Lagarde, the director of the IMF, said, you know, this didn't happen. But reading through the lines at her press conference today, it was quite obvious that, you know, an approach had been made. Now, quite separate to that is the question about Greece trying to get a deal with the rest of the eurozone. Because what the rest of the eurozone have said is that Greece must give the rest of the eurozone a list of reforms that it's going to enact in order for the latest tranche of bailout money in the second Greek program to be released. So there's still $7 billion that Greece is due from the eurozone. But until they have some reforms on the table, the eurozone won't release it. And this has been going back and forth for 2 months.
But the problems that the Greeks will say is, it's all very well you're saying you want reforms, but we've tried a lot of the reforms that you've asked for over the last 5 years, and look where we are. We were elected on a platform of not having these reforms.
Yes, but this is the problem. This is the problem with Syriza. So they campaigned on an anti-austerity platform, saying it was the end of the Troika, it was the end of austerity. However, they also promised the Greek people that they wouldn't leave the eurozone, that they would still maintain the common currency. So you have promises which are incompatible with the economic reality. But then it was obvious whilst they were campaigning that leaving the euro was never really an option, and still over 80% of Greek people say that they want to remain in the eurozone. So that's the fundamental problem here. But unless Greece does some kind of cursory, you know, attempt at putting forward some structural reforms, it's very clear that the rest of the eurozone aren't going to release the money. And to this point, so obviously we follow this very closely, and to this point we thought some kind of extend and pretend deal would be struck. But it's dragging on. Time is running out. They only have a few weeks left. And it looks likely that they might run out of money in May.
James Boyes, the other option, of course, is that the eurozone countries, led by Germany, hold their hands up and say, you're right, we're sorry, we got this wrong. Austerity has been terrible for you. You know, it takes two to tango. Our bank shouldn't have lent so much at such generous rates. Let's try and sort all this out properly.
Wouldn't that be lovely? I think it's probably unlikely, quite frankly. I think extend and pretend, I love that. It's a great line. I'm going to remember that one. I think that if you look at the situation, there's no doubt about it, but you've got a massive contradiction, as Nina rightly pointed out, between what was said on the campaign trail and what is feasible in office. And this is one of the great problems, is it's very, very easy on a campaign trail. And again, this comes back to some of the things we were talking about beforehand, to say one thing and get people all whipped up and excited and say, yes, we're going to do this, this and the other. And then you get into office and you suddenly run up against the cold, hard facts of what those actually mean when you try to implement in an office. And as soon as you've got, as Nina rightly pointed out, the majority of the population who are opposed to the idea of austerity but don't want to come out of the euro, how on earth do you square that circle? I think the most interesting thing from a political point of view will be this idea of will the euro leadership allow a nation to leave the project? Because if you allow one person to leave the project, does that open up the floodgate in the potential future for other nations to start moving on?
But Nina, surely the other problem with Greece leaving the euro is that then, you know, all this debt, which the eurozone countries have taken on from the European banks. Let's not forget that it was the eurozone's decision to take on this debt. They could have just said, "Well, look, sorry, banks, but you screwed up. Tough." But they said, "Oh no, we'll take on this debt. Europe will lose that debt."
Yes, but this is, one must never underestimate the political will to keep the euro together.
But you say, don't underestimate the political will to leave, to keep the euro together. But then,
But then
why won't they compromise them with? Why won't they then themselves take the hit instead of Greece?
Well, this is why. When the Greek had their second, Greece had its second bailout. What happened is that Greek debt, which was held by private institutions, was transferred into public institutions. So that means that the eurozone taxpayer is liable for Greek debt. And let's not forget that the other European leaders are also liable to their own public. So if you say to Greece, we're going to write off your debt, and I think some form of debt haircut is necessary for Greece, then all of a sudden you have to sell that at home to your electorates. And it's not just the Germans. Mm-hmm. The Germans hold a lot of Greek debt, but the rest of the eurozone taxpayers too. I mean,
I think my point on
Italy.
This is that it's all very well us sitting around here and going, oh, well, Greece, aren't they bad? Aren't they terrible? But actually, you know, this was the European banks that shouldn't have lent the money in the first place. And it's European political leaders that have made the decision to take on that debt themselves.
Well, absolutely. And I think you're hitting on a broader point here. I mean, what this hits to the very heart of the eurozone crisis and the crisis we see in the EU and Europe as fundamentally, like, what is the EU supposed to be and what is the eurozone supposed to be? Is it going to be a transfer union where countries like Germany make permanent fiscal transfers to poorer countries like Greece, which of course the northern countries, the creditor countries, don't want? Mm-hmm. And this is exactly what we're seeing playing out here.
But also on that point, those northern countries, and Germany in particular, have benefited enormously over the last 15 years from being in the euro, haven't they?
Well, they have, as in their exports were a lot cheaper than, you know, if they still had the Deutsche Mark. However, that's an argument that we hear quite a lot, and being a German, they find quite annoying when, like, the Anglo-Saxons press is lecturing them on, you know, how much they've benefited from the euro.
Not lecturing, just pointing out.
But let's not forget that Germany has also, you know, paid a lot to keep kind of the euro project together.
We'll leave it on that note. Now, as we mentioned before, Monocle's first ever Quality of Life conference takes place this weekend. And even if you're not going to be there yourself, don't worry, because you can tune in live to Monocle 24 all day on Saturday. We're inviting you, basically, to this very special event full of peerless hospitality, great debates and in-depth conversations about the forces shaping the world's great cities. We're going to be talking a lot about quality of life and what makes a city great. At the end of this programme, James Boyes, if you had the opportunity to live anywhere in the world, any city, what would it? Where would it be and why?
Oh, I'm just trying to work out, did we just get invited to Lisbon? I'm just checking. Where would I live?
You get to listen.
Yeah, thank you. Washington, D.C. I was at an event recently. I got asked the same thing. Close your eyes. Where would you like to be? I'm very, really lucky. I've got a job I love doing. I work at university. I get to liaise and work with government and media. I love working here in London, but if I had to be anywhere else...
But is that for quality of life, or is that just because quality the of, job would...
No,
the
it,
work,
it would
be
everything. It would be an interesting climate. It would be access to a lot of the materials I'm interested in. Quality of life. You've got access to the rest of the United States. So quite frankly, I'd be on the Chesapeake somewhere.
Sounds like you're pitching for something.
Heaven forbid.
Nina Schick, where, you know, you're living in London, one of the greatest cities in the world. Is London the place the with the best quality of life?
No. I mean, London has wonderful things about it, but I wouldn't say quality of life necessarily rates highest in London. I would say Berlin. It's a very cultural city, young city, full of arts, especially if you have an interest in politics, you can do that. But, you know, it has so much to offer. And it's very, very cheap to live in Berlin. So one
compared to London.
Yes.
Everywhere's cheap.
Okay, there we are. So Berlin and Washington, D.C., two correct. Slightly different choices there. Washington doesn't get into Markle's Quality of Life Index. Berlin does. Although there are actually other German cities that do slightly better. There are. Don't look at me like that. I mean, look, London doesn't get into the list at all. And yet,
wow.
I think London's fantastic.
What a surprise.
Well, there we are. Birmingham isn't on the list. And
darn it.
No idea why that isn't. Okay, right, that brings us to the end of the programme. Nina Schick and James Boyce, thank you both very much indeed. The show was produced by Ben Ryland, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Caroline Harmagren. The studio manager was Toby Hammond. Coming up, music, then Andrew Tuck with The Urbanist at 1900 Hours. We're back tomorrow with Midori House, and of course do join us all Saturday in Lisbon for the Quality of Life Conference. I'm Steve Bloomfield. Thanks for listening. Goodbye.